Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. If you're a regular listener, you know that I recorded a show just 2 weeks ago focusing on the University of California, Berkeley Wellness Letter. It's not only laziness on my part that I'm returning to this again today. It really does have a lot of good varied information. So I think you won't be bored by their material. As a reminder, for more than 30 years, the University of California at Berkeley has been publishing a wellness letter. In it, researchers, doctors, and wellness experts from the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley and elsewhere report on the best studies and information available to promote optimal physical and mental well-being. So, we will cover a lot of different topics, and I hope that at least some of them will be of interest to you. And we are going to start with EGAD, e-cigarettes. While the debate continues about whether e-cigarettes help people quit smoking or actually serve as a gateway to starting smoking or a crutch to continuing, research is accumulating about some of the potential harms of these electronic devices. Though e-cigs don't contain tar and many other harmful constituents of tobacco, they emit chemicals known or suspected to be dangerous. Here are some recent studies. Lung damage. In a study of 2,100 teenagers, 11th or 12th graders, in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine, researchers found a strong link between e-cig use and bronchitis and other respiratory problems after controlling for tobacco smoking. The FDA has banned sale of e-cigs to children under 18. Last summer, California raised the age to 21, the same as for tobacco products. Damage to gums and other oral cells. In a lab study in the Journal of Cellular Physiology, researchers found that half of cells from human gums died when exposed to e-cig vapor for just 15 minutes a day for 3 days. Similarly, a lab study in the journal OncoTarget found that e-cig vapor, especially when containing flavorings, produced oxidative stress, inflammation, and DNA damage in isolated cells from healthy human mouths, effects that could lead to various oral diseases. Explosions. Injuries from exploding e-cigs appear to be on the rise, according to a research letter in the New England Journal of Medicine. Often serious, the injuries include flame and chemical burns, along with damage from flying debris. The main culprits are overheated batteries that rupture and burst into flames or explode, damaging hands, face, or the thigh and groin area. In most cases, e-cigs explode while in use, but sometimes when they are in pockets. Brave new world of nanoparticles. Man-made nanoparticles are being added to more and more foods, cosmetics, drugs, and other products, and are ultimately finding their way into the environment. The name of these minuscule particles comes from the word nanometer, which is 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter. How small is that? A sheet of newspaper is 100,000 nanometers thick, a pinhead about 1,000,000 nanometers across. The synthesis and use of these particles is called nanotechnology, which is playing a role in everything from engineering and physics to biology and chemistry. If nanoparticles isn't in your lexicon yet, the following Q&A will explain why it should be. Where are nanoparticles found? Almost everywhere. More than 1,700 consumer products containing nanoparticles have been introduced into the marketplace since 2005. A paper in Environmental Science and Technology in 2012 revealed that titanium dioxide nanoparticles, for instance, are now widely used in food, notably chewing gum, sweets, and candies, dietary supplements, and personal care products, notably sunscreens and toothpastes, sometimes accounting for as much as 10% of their total weight. Nanotechnology is also used to make auto parts, and nanoparticles are added to clothing, cosmetics, food packaging, bandages, and medical products, as well as some dental implants and eyeglass lenses. Why do manufacturers use them? The nanoparticle size provides many desirable properties, allowing products to be lighter in weight, yet stronger, for instance, and to have greater chemical reactivity than their larger particle counterparts. The chemical composition of the nanoparticles is an important factor, since chemistry as well as size determine both beneficial and potentially toxic effects. In sunscreens, nanoparticles of zinc oxide and titanium dioxide allow efficient blocking of ultraviolet rays without a white, pasty look. Drugs made with nanoparticles can have improved solubility and bioavailability, allowing for faster therapeutic action. A nanoparticle paste used in bone surgery allows for faster fracture repair. Eyeglass lenses made with nanotechnology are harder to scratch and easier to clean. The auto industry uses nanotechnology to make lightweight materials. Some clothing, such as underwear and socks, contains nanosilver, which is marketed to reduce odor. In foods, nanoparticles can add dramatic flavors and brighter colors and increase shelf life. For instance, Dunkin' Donuts used nanoparticles, titanium dioxide, in its white powdered donuts. After a consumer group's lab test revealed this, the company stopped using this ingredient. Many food-related uses for nanoparticles are in development to improve the bioavailability of fat-soluble nutrients such as lycopene and beta-carotene, to enhance satiety of diet foods, and to improve probiotic supplements so that their potentially beneficial bacteria survive longer in the large intestine. Do nanoparticles pose health or environmental risks? Humans have always been exposed to nanoparticles. Many air pollutants from volcanic eruptions, forest fires, and motor vehicles are nanoparticles, which can unfortunately penetrate deep into our lungs when we inhale them. But it's the new uses of nanotechnology that are raising concerns among scientists as well as consumer groups. The EPA recently began studying nanoparticles in commercial products to determine if they pose environmental and health risks. Some animal studies have found that nanoparticles can cross the blood-brain barrier, which protects the brain from potentially toxic substances in the blood. And lab experiments have found that exposure to titanium dioxide nanoparticles can affect human cells in ways that may damage DNA and increase cancer risk. Workers in nanoparticle-related industries have the highest potential exposure to the particles and thus face the greatest risks. The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health states that inhaled nanoparticles are more toxic than larger particles, but that much remains unknown. Not only do nanoparticles stay airborne longer, they are more likely to be deposited in the respiratory tract, can remain in tissues longer, and are more biologically active than larger particles. Thus, a few studies on occupational exposure have linked certain types of nanoparticles to severe lung damage. As for the environment, when products containing nanoparticles are thrown away, they end up in landfills and the particles eventually get into soil and waterways with unknown effects on animals and crops. And when people swim, nanoparticles in their sunscreen and cosmetics wash off into oceans and lakes. When they bathe, the particles go down the drain and pass through sewage treatment plants into marine ecosystems. Are nanoparticles being regulated? Very little. So far, the FDA has put the responsibility for nanoparticle safety primarily in industry's lap and does not require the labeling of nanoparticles even in food. Two leading consumer organizations, the Environmental Working Group and Consumers Union, have called for increased safety assessments and regulation by the government. In contrast, the European Union now requires the labeling of nanoparticles in foods. What can you do if you want to avoid nanoparticles? Keep in mind, there's no conclusive evidence that nanoparticles are harming us or the environment. In fact, some uses, as in medical products, help improve health. Still, more research is needed. Meanwhile, if you want to reduce your exposure, you can avoid sunscreens, cosmetics, and processed foods that contain titanium dioxide or zinc oxide, though other chemicals in these products may also be nanoparticles. In addition, you can avoid products boasting about their nanotechnology, like some anti-odor underwear. Buying organic foods won't necessarily help, however, since regulations do not forbid nanoparticles. Still, such additives go against organic principles, so organic producers are less likely to use them. Reiki really. And I should say this is coming from the wellness letter of February 2017. Perhaps you've heard of Reiki, a type of laying on of hands and energy practice that is being used in some hospitals and other mainstream medical settings. While proponents say it promotes relaxation and overall wellness, reduces stress and pain, and has healing effects for a range of conditions, including cancer, critics call it a pseudoscience or downright quackery. Just what is the evidence for Reiki, the origins of which can be traced back to ancient Eastern spiritual texts? The word Reiki comes from the Japanese rei, meaning universal life, and ki, meaning energy. During a typical session, the patient lies down or sits, fully clothed, while the practitioner places his or her hands on or just above different body parts for a few minutes in each spot. The idea, in brief, is that energy supposedly passes from the practitioner to the patient to bring about a natural healing response. Several organizations provide Reiki instruction, and many nurses and other medical staff, along with volunteers, are being trained in some hospitals. But the techniques vary, and there is no national licensing for practitioners who may have anywhere from one day to several years of training. A few studies have reported benefits from Reiki, such as reductions in pain, anxiety, and depression, but nearly all the studies are small and of poor quality. Most lack a control group, which makes it hard to tease out the effect that comes simply from the attention, comfort, and gentle touch provided by the practitioner, all of which may have therapeutic effects. That is, the physical act of making contact with another person likely has benefit, or the benefit may be due to a relaxation response, but this has nothing to do with the underlying tenets of the practice, which claim that the effects result from the transfer of universal life force. There is no scientific evidence of the existence of such energy, let alone that humans can channel it. Only a few studies have compared Reiki, done by a trained practitioner, to a placebo, a sham treatment done by an untrained person, which would be the best way to determine therapeutic effectiveness. In one, in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine in 2008, neither Reiki nor a placebo had an effect on pain, physical or mental functioning, medication use, or number of doctor visits in people with fibromyalgia. Another study, an Oncology Nursing Forum in 2011, found that both Reiki and sham Reiki improved self-reported comfort and well-being in chemotherapy patients compared to standard treatment, which suggests that participants may have felt better simply because of the attention, the researchers said. In other words, the benefits may be due to a placebo effect. Several reviews have noted that because of methodological problems in trials, no conclusions about Reiki's effectiveness can be made. Even the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine says that Reiki hasn't been clearly shown to be useful for any health-related purpose. The website quackwatch.com goes one step further, calling it nonsense, with no substantiated health value and no scientifically plausible rationale. Bottom line, we don't doubt that Reiki can promote relaxation and other feel-good effects, just like massage, music therapy, or other alternative practices, with patient expectations perhaps being the most important factor in positive outcomes. We can't endorse a therapy that is not proven to be better than a placebo, but because no adverse effects have been documented, there's no harm in trying Reiki for overall relaxation and stress reduction. If you are dealing with a chronic condition or acute illness, don't use it in place of standard medical care. As one paper concluded, it seems likely that this kind of therapy may offer some relief to those who are attracted to it. Don't ignore buckling knees. Knee buckling, that is, having your knees give way when you put weight on them, is a sign of knee instability. It increases the risk of falling, and it's particularly common in older people who have weak leg muscles, particularly the quadriceps, muscles on the front of the thighs, poor balance, or chronic knee problems, from arthritis, for example. Knee buckling is a warning sign that shouldn't be ignored, as noted in a recent NIH-sponsored study in arthritis care and research. Researchers interviewed 1,842 people, ages 55 to 84, who had knee osteoarthritis or were at high risk for it, and found that 17% had experienced knee buckling with or without falling during the past 3 months. Interviews 2 years later revealed that these participants were 2 to 4 times more likely to have fallen during the previous year compared to those who hadn't experienced prior buckling. Falls resulting from a sporting or cycling mishap, being knocked down by a person or vehicle, or using a ladder were not included. Of major concern, about 2/3 of participants who fell reported that they lost confidence in their balance and feared falling again, so much so that they limited their activities. But that only leads to further loss of muscle strength and overall conditioning, which can in turn result in greater loss of mobility, isolation, dependence on others, and possibly depression. Such consequences, the researchers said, can often be prevented in people whose buckling knees are caused by muscle weakness or poor balance if they do quadriceps strengthening exercises and balance and agility training. If you've experienced knee instability or buckling, tell your healthcare provider. Patients often don't bring this up, and they are seldom asked about it. Your healthcare provider can advise some basic exercises for balance and strength, or refer you to a physical therapist. If you are overweight, this is more incentive to lose extra pounds, which put added strain on your knees. Discuss other fall prevention measures, such as wearing slip-resistant shoes and socks and using a cane if necessary. And there's a column here called Ask the Experts. Question: can wearing compression socks boost running performance? Answer: not likely. Many runners, basketball players, and other athletes wear them, hoping the socks will boost their performance and reduce the risk of muscle soreness and injuries. These ultra-strong elastic socks, typically knee-high, are similar to those often recommended for people who have circulatory problems. It has been proposed that compression socks could benefit athletes by pressing on muscles and veins in the ankles and legs, thus improving blood flow back to the heart and allowing it to pump more efficiently. The socks might also reduce side-to-side movement of calf muscles while running, for example, thus reducing the risk of muscle damage. However, proponents of compression socks primarily cite anecdotes. For example, athletes who report that their legs feel less sore after wearing the socks. Studies on the subject have mostly been small and poorly designed, no control group, for example. Few, if any, good studies have found significant benefits for exercise. Question: can people with pre-diabetes take the drug metformin to prevent or at least delay the onset of full-blown diabetes? Answer: yes, but it is recommended only if intensive lifestyle changes haven't helped, according to 2016 guidelines from the American Diabetes Association, ADA. People with prediabetes, sometimes called impaired glucose tolerance, have fasting blood glucose levels between 100 and 125. Normal is below 100, while above 125 is considered diabetes. It's estimated that more than 1/3 of American adults have prediabetes. Metformin is usually the initial drug used to treat type 2 diabetes. The FDA has not approved it for prediabetes, so such use is considered off-label. The ADA cited research showing that an intensive diet and physical activity counseling program that promotes weight loss is most effective for the prevention of diabetes in people with prediabetes. The Important Diabetes Prevention Program study from 2002, for instance, found that such a program reduced the rate of progression of prediabetes to diabetes by 60% over 3 years. Metformin was only half as effective overall. But among participants under 60 who were very obese, the drug was as effective as the counseling program. It is much better to prevent diabetes by improving your diet and exercise habits than to take a drug, presumably for the rest of your life. Such lifestyle changes and resulting weight loss will have a host of other health benefits as well. But for obese people who have repeatedly failed with the lifestyle program, medication may be an option. Question: do any home remedies for toenail fungus work? Answer: some may hold promise, but overall there's little or no evidence that they are effective. Many remedies have been tried, including tea tree oil, olive oil, camphophanique, vitamin E, and Listerine. Some, such as dipping toes in beer, are innocuous, but dipping them in bleach can be harmful. Various essential oils, such as clove, oregano, thyme, and lavender, have been shown to have antifungal activity, but studies are needed to determine if they can penetrate the nail bed, according to a review in Mycopathologia in 2015. Two products have very preliminary evidence behind them. A small study in 2011 found that 15 out of 18 people with toenail fungus had a positive response with Vicks VapoRub, which contains thymol, menthol, camphor, and eucalyptus oil. About one quarter were cured after 48 weeks. A small study from Washington University in 2016 also reported significant improvements. Another product is a topical resin from the coniferous Norway spruce tree, which has been tested in two small Finnish studies, though the authors were shareholders of a company that develops and markets resin-based products for medical purposes, and the product is not readily available here. In one of the studies, which was published in the British Journal of Dermatology in 2015, this nail lacquer worked as well as topical amorphine lacqueril, but not nearly as well as the oral antifungal drug terbinafine. For more about toenail fungus and conventional medical treatments, see tinyurl.com/toenailfungusWL. A last word, a placebo prescription. A placebo, Latin for I shall please, is a sham treatment such as a dummy pill customarily administered to someone who is unaware that it is not a real treatment. The benefit it can produce is called the placebo effect, which occurs when belief in a treatment or in the power of a trusted practitioner actually helps the remedy work and triggers an improvement in symptoms and health. Since ancient times, it has been known that the hope and expectation people experience when treated, even with a sugar pill, can play a role in recovery. But what if people in pain are told that a treatment is a placebo? Could that possibly help them? Yes, according to a study from Portugal recently in the journal Pain, which included 83 adults with chronic low back pain. Half were randomly assigned their usual pain medications alone. The other half got their usual medications plus a placebo. But unlike gold standard double-blind placebo-controlled clinical trials in which neither the participants nor researchers know who is getting the sham treatment, the placebo group in this study received dummy pills labeled placebo. What's more, the researchers explained the potential power of the placebo effect and how the body may respond. After 3 weeks, the placebo group reported a clinically significant 30% reduction in pain and disability, compared to little or no improvement in the usual treatment group. Low back pain is often hard to treat, and there's a great need for effective treatments. Conventional clinical trials often find that commonly prescribed treatments for back pain are not significantly more effective than a placebo, but have more side effects. So why not just give patients placebos? If doctors lead patients to believe that a placebo is a real drug, that's deception. Giving placebos openly and explaining how the placebo effect can work offers a way to overcome this ethical problem. This study was short, so it's not known if the placebo's benefits would have persisted. In addition, it was advertised as a novel mind-body clinical study, so it might have attracted people who are particularly open to complementary and alternative treatments. Our data suggests that open-label placebo can be a safe and effective adjunct to treatment for chronic low back pain, the researchers concluded. They called for further research evaluating the potential for harnessing placebo effects without deception for back pain and other conditions. Wellness made easy is the last column we're getting here today. If you have migraines, melatonin supplements may help reduce their frequency, suggests a recent Brazilian study in the Journal of Neurology, Neurosurgery, and Psychiatry. It involved 178 adults ages 18 to 65 who regularly suffered from migraines and were divided into three groups: melatonin 3 milligrams, standard migraine medication amitriptyline 25 milligrams, or a placebo, all taken at bedtime for 12 weeks. Melatonin reduced migraine frequency as much as the drug, with fewer side effects, and was even more likely to reduce migraine frequency by at least half. Melatonin may help prevent migraines by acting on various brain chemicals, reducing inflammation, and in other ways, the researchers suggested. Using a sit-stand desk burns only a few extra calories an hour. According to a small study in occupational medicine, researchers had 18 people do standardized desk work while standing, sitting, or alternating between standing and sitting every half hour. Standing for an hour burned on average 8 extra calories compared to sitting for a 165-pound person, while dividing the hour between sitting and standing burned 6 extra calories. Well, I'm not going to run out and get myself a sit-stand desk. Thank you for tuning in to Sound Body today. Stay well, and I hope you'll come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.